And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Higher Dimensions. We've had a time off while I took some extra training for the past couple of weeks. I've been up in near Boston and also out in Maryland doing training in hypnotherapy and Jin Shin Jutsu training, a healing art. But today, and I'm also glad to welcome you back and to say how glad I am to be back, talking to wonderful guests that I have. And today I've snagged a really nice person, Stanton T. Friedman. He is a nuclear physicist and co-author of Captured, and we spoke to the other co-author, the niece of Barney and Betty Hill, prior to this 6 months ago. And today, however, we're talking with Mr. Friedman about flying saucers and science. The name of his book, I think it's your most recent book, is it not, Mr. Friedman?
Oh, yeah. It came out late May, early June. It's already in its third printing.
Yes. At any rate, it's A Scientist Investigates the Mysteries of UFOs. I've read your book, sir. I make it my habit to make sure that I read books of anyone who comes on my show. It's just a matter of courtesy for me. But welcome, welcome to our show.
Delighted to be on.
Thank you. I'm so glad to have you here. Now, tell us, what inspired you to write this book? Tell us a little bit about yourself. I know you're not an unfamiliar guest to BBS Radio, but for my show, you are. So please tell us a little bit about yourself.
I grew up in New Jersey. I spent 2 years at Rutgers, 3 years at the University of Chicago. Carl Sagan and I were classmates for 3 years. He never bragged about that, but that's I'm still around, and unfortunately, he's not.
Yes.
And we went different directions. He went into academia. I spent 14 years in industry, working on a wide variety of very advanced, exciting, advanced nuclear and space system development programs that eventually got canceled.
It sounds like government to me.
Well, it was. They were government-sponsored, and they were big companies, GE, GM,
right.
Westinghouse, Aerojet, General,
right.
PRW Systems. And some of the programs were big, and it's not a question of bragging, but
yes.
A lot of people don't understand that if you want high technology development, you don't go to some university.
No, you don't.
You go out to industry. And when I was working at General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1958, I was there for 3 years, but in 1958 we were spending $100 million.
Which is a big chunk of change then.
It certainly was, and there were 3,500 people employed full-time, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. And we did test jet engines on nuclear power, but we don't have any nuclear airplanes flying around. But that's a typical development program for that time frame. It's not six professors and 12 grad students, in other words. Very extensive work. Very exciting, classified, and canceled.
Why
and
was
I
it canceled?
It was canceled because well, the main reason seemed to be that, to my mind anyway, based on later experience as well, that there was a lack of leadership. There was nobody who said, hey, this is where we're going. We're going to get there. If you don't want to get there, get off the train. Admiral Rickover was my... He was somebody who knew what he wanted to do and got it done. There was nobody like that on the ANP program. And no leadership is what I'm saying.
And I find that really strange. But did you find that typical governmental?
Well, it's not only government and industry together. Yeah, the people from the government didn't know what they wanted, and the people in industry were saying, well, it's a cost-plus contract, so what? You know, doesn't matter. And the need for, what's the word I want here, strong stand about a program that is going to be useful. Admiral Rickover, for example, he's the one, for your listeners who might not know, who pushed the development of the nuclear submarine.
Oh, yes. I'm very familiar with that gentleman. I read about his life.
Marvelous
man.
He's quite a guy. And,
marvelous.
The kicker was that Congress learned they could trust him.
Yes.
But there were people who were opposed to what he was doing. The battleship boys said, why should you build a submarine? What are you going to do with a submarine? Build a bigger, better battleship, you know, or aircraft carrier, whatever.
So we're talking turf wars and egos here?
Oh, yeah. And also a lack of imagination. people don't realize, today we think of nuclear submarines, among many other things, as a way of carrying Polaris missiles
right.
so that if the U.S. gets attacked, we would be able to retaliate because
right.
they wouldn't know where our submarines were.
Right.
But you realize when the nuclear submarine was formulated and built, nobody had built a Polaris missile. That came
right.
after. Somebody said, you got a ship that can stay underwater for months, years?
And what are we going to do with it now?
Yeah, look what we can do with that, you know. But the nuclear airplane, the program, at first we're going to fly an airplane that will go higher, farther, faster, with more
right.
payload than any other airplane that's ever been built.
Right, but it comes down at some point, doesn't it?
Well, at some point they decided, it'll be a high-altitude bomber. No, it'll go in low on the deck to avoid radar, then take off and come back at high altitude. They didn't know what they wanted to do.
Mm.
When that happens, programs get canceled.
Huh.
They also melted down a reactor out at the Idaho test station.
Oh, boy.
That didn't help. Nobody got hurt, but,
right.
you know, it didn't help.
Right.
And so that was one program. Fission nuclear rockets at Westinghouse, we operated those successfully on the ground. There
mm-hmm.
were Los Alamos and Aerojet
right.
General and
right.
Westinghouse.
Mm-hmm.
We all built reactors that worked, and the biggest one was built by Los Alamos, just to give you a number that's kind of
mm-hmm.
exciting to me anyway. The Phoebus, how's that for a name,
uh-huh.
had a diameter under 7 feet and a power level, the Phoebus 2B, of 4,400 megawatts. Now, the power level of Grand Coulee Dam is 2,000 megawatts.
Wow, that's 2.5 times.
Yeah, but look how small it was.
Yeah,
and,
wow.
So it was exciting, and it would make a great upper stage if you want to go to Mars. But
right.
there again, the program was a success. The operation was a success, but the patient died because there was no leadership. I did sit in on a meeting. I was a little older by this time at Aerojet
mm-hmm.
of the Space Nuclear Propulsion Office, people from NASA and Aerojet,
okay.
and I was there. And the purpose of the meeting, what should we do with the nuclear rocket? And you know what? They hadn't the faintest idea what they wanted
what?
To do. Well, we could do this, we could do that, we could do something else. When you don't have a goal, away you go.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because you would have thought that they would set it up with a particular goal in mind. I mean, that to me is a concept of you start out with a goal in mind and then you find your way there. That
well,
to me is orally
confident.
Well,
it didn't work that way. The goal seemed to be develop technology and we'll see what you have when you get there kind of thing. And that you're right, that's not the way to go. It was exciting. I mean,
yeah.
I had experiments on our reactor, which was only 1,100 megawatts, half the power
right.
of Grand Coulee Dam. And when you listen to the test going on, and we didn't know how long the reactor would operate for,
mm-hmm.
and the betting was 10 minutes, 20 minutes, maybe the fuel elements would come out in 30 minutes.
It went
a full hour.
A full hour.
Yeah,
wow.
And that's all that you need for upper stage for Mars, incidentally. And
really?
Yeah. People think that our deep space probes and so forth are powered. They're coasting. They're
yes.
coasting just
yeah.
about all the way. When we go to the moon, it takes
mm-hmm.
69 hours, but powered flight for 17 minutes.
Yeah, it's to get out, then gravity or lack of gravity, I say.
Well, gravity will do it. You know, you shoot
yeah.
an arrow into the air, and if you shoot it in the right direction at
yeah.
the right time, it goes someplace else.
Yes, it does. I was talking with someone coming back, speaking of governments, and talking with him about the concept of using hypnosis in PTSD syndrome and tried to get the government to, especially the VA, which has a great
yeah.
reluctance to acknowledge that people who go into combat, get shot at, get hurt, get wounded, have friends die in their arms, suffer from anything that approaches a trauma. I don't know where they have this thinking, but I mentioned using hypnosis and what my plans were with some partners. And he proceeded to give me a description of how pie in the sky was because I actually had a goal. I had an idea. And he said, do you know how many years you'll be stuck in doing that? And it'll never come about because bureaucrats don't like to take risks. And I'm guessing what you're telling me in another form is exactly that. He said, the name of the game is to protect your job and keep your head ducked down low.
Well, he's right, except that in that particular instance, Dr. Benjamin Simon, who did the hypnosis, the regressive medical hypnosis described and captured the Biddy and Barney Hill
right.
UFO experience,
right.
Dr. Simon ran a 3,000-bed hospital, the mm-hmm. Mason Hospital, which was the people who were there were World War II war veterans with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And it was his use of hypnosis, medical hypnosis. He developed very special techniques to induce amnesia after each session and not introduce the patient to what he had said until he was ready for it and so forth and so on. And he had a tremendous success rate. There's even a movie. Kathleen Martin has a copy. Showed it to me, as a matter of fact. Let There Be Light, starring Dr. Simon, made by the Army, in which they used hypnosis to do exactly the kind of thing you're talking about. And he was a gutsy guy. He didn't know anything about flying saucers, but he sure knew about getting rid of post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Well, I had done some volunteer work back in the at Walter Reed Army Medical Hospital, and this is not World War II, I'm not that old, but with a Korean war vet who also had breakdowns.
Of course they did.
And it was called the Neuropsychiatric Division, and they were using some pretty barbaric techniques, at least at that time, I think, with the frontal lobotomies, the shock, shock treatment, which they find is really not that helpful, all things being equal.
No. But it takes a skilled person now. Dr. Simon was skilled.
Yes. But there is a tremendous work that is being done in these days and age, which can help people. And there seems to be a general reluctance, and I'm finding some of it is just professional jealousy. Well, if somebody else can do this who's not with an MD or a psychiatric degree or a psychotherapy degree behind their name, you know, it's like they want to protect my turf and make sure there's in it what's in it for us and so forth and so on. And they throw up more barriers than they tear down.
But I think you're right, and I think that applies in a lot of other different directions.
Yes.
But, well, let me give you another example from from fancy propulsion systems. The one that was most exciting, really, was nuclear fusion at Aerojet General Nucleonics. And that was to go to the stars. And we had, it was a small contract, $9 million, which was peanuts. But we showed that using the new superconducting magnets to create high magnetic fields and picking the right nuclear fusion reaction, you could kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. Papers were published, reports were published, and that was the end of the program. We finished our program. I was working on the shielding for that. You do want to protect people. It's kind of a good idea that the crew is
I'm
still able to function, you know.
You know, death by lethal, you know, radiation is not something one wants.
Not much, anyway. A little bit is good, but a lot is bad. Hey, that's true. There are a lot of useful things we do with radiation,
absolutely.
After all.
Well,
I'm a nuclear guy, remember?
Yeah, I know there's x-rays and there's sonograms and there's a whole bunch of stuff we do.
Nuclear medicine, incidentally, is used in an awful lot of tests at the hospital.
Yes.
And you don't hear the word exploratory surgery much anymore.
Right.
Because we have nuclear techniques for looking inside the body without cutting it open first.
Which I think is fabulous.
Yeah, it's great.
It saves a lot. No, I'm not a physicist, but I have absolutely every... I agree with you on that. I've been in the healthcare field for many, many years, and you know, I'm surprised at how primitive it still is when it could have been moved so much forward with more innovation and more openness and less jealousy.
Leadership.
And,
yes.
Well, people are so afraid of doing anything, and also they also want to know, how can I make money at it?
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess I'm not the right sort of guy. What the heck? Money is not the major consideration. Obviously, there aren't too many nuclear physicists running around the country lecturing about flying saucers are real and writing books about flying saucers, but I'm not asking for competition, you understand.
Oh, no? Oh, gee whiz. I thought that would be a nice little bit of a spice.
Let me get back to fusion for a minute.
Go ahead.
You know, there's a whole chapter in the new book that you can get here from there.
Sure.
And it's one of the major, the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them when I'm being polite. You know, there are a few arguments that they make. A, there's no evidence, so I have chapter two, which goes into five large-scale scientific studies.
No evidence of what? That it works?
Of flying saucers, that some flying saucers are alien spacecraft. But
really?
When you look at their publications, you find that they haven't looked at any of the evidence, like
That's
the five
right.
large-scale scientific studies that I talk about in Chapter 2.
Well, you made mention of that, and I'm also, well, no, I'm not. people love being ignorant. I don't know why, but they love being ignorant.
They take pride, I guess.
Yes. Ignorance is bliss. Isn't that the old saying?
Yeah. And second area that they talk about is you can't get here from there. And that's particularly true of the, what, you'll pardon my expression, but I call them the SETI cultists. You know, S-E-T-I,
oh, yes.
Silly
yes,
Effort to
yes.
Investigate, you know.
Yes.
They never look at the UFO evidence. I read their books. They don't read mine, of course, and you never find references. They'll tell you there is no evidence. What they really mean is, I'm not going to look at UFO evidence, and I might have to give up some notion that the way to find extraterrestrial intelligence is to listen for signals. These are hypothetical signals. They provide no evidence there's anybody out there, or if there is somebody out there, he's going to send signals that we can pick up with our primitive techniques.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we act like we're the smart guys in the neighborhood. I think we're one of the most primitive ones in the neighborhood.
Well, I remember, I was born and raised in D.C. I well remember, it was 56, 57 the summer, when there were UFOs all over the sky. And the newspapers were full of it. And there were scrambled planes
yes,
flying
1952,
all over.
1952, that was the
biggie. That was it. Okay,
yeah.
Whatever year it was, I was here, and I saw it. And I've also seen a UFO over Rock Creek Park in downtown D.C. And somebody asked me, are you sure you didn't mistake it for a helicopter? And I looked at him, and I said, I think I know what a helicopter looks like, but let me.
It sounds like.
Yeah. And I said, besides which, would you have the kind of helicopter you're talking about flying that near the White House? And he said, no, we wouldn't. So I said, ergo, it was a flying saucer. So that was
the biggest year in Blue Book history, was 1952.
Well, this was back in 1990-something that I saw this UFO right over Rock Creek Park. I was wondering why I almost drove into the Jersey Wall, because I looked up and here was this huge UFO hovering right over the park. And the trees were bending down, and I just thought to myself, oh, shite, I know what that is. And it was like there was a mental conversation going on between I and the person in the, what I, for lack of a better word, would be cockpit room, you know, whatever it was, control room. And there was a mental conversation going on, and the time had to either be suspended because of the conversation that went on. And some information was given me that nobody could know about except somebody who read my mind, okay? And
well, I think they do read minds.
Well, of course they do. That's one reason. That's one way how they communicate, which is how, A, parents communicate with their children. Pets and humans communicate with each other. I mean, it is, again, that to me is a valid form of communication.
Well, when I was at the exact location with Kathleen Martin, the co-author on Captured, where Betty and Barney Hill were abducted, it was perfectly obvious that there was no way in the world that Barney would have turned off the main road to a secondary road and then again to a tertiary road unless the guy upstairs was directing him.
Exactly.
Right to a location, the only place in the area big enough for a saucer to come down, surrounded by trees.
Right.
And you look at that, and then you also recognize every government would like to be able to control people's behavior from a distance, wouldn't they? Drop your guns now, gentlemen. You know.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why Bulgaria and Russia and a few other countries tried to use hypnosis to make what I would call robots out of human beings, and they found it doesn't work.
People are a little stronger and more powerful mentally than we give them credit for, I'm afraid.
Well, I also believe we have souls and that you move into a different, this is my opinion, mind you, that we move into an entirely different realm of scientific qualities when you work with the mind, because I think it's something that we don't have all the tools yet in our possession to work with and explore. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, and remember, we were looking at LSD and other drugs for their use in mind control, especially after the Korean War, where we found out that a lot of our guys had been, quote, brainwashed, unquote.
Right.
Powerful technique. You know, and that does relate, though, to something that's an important part of the whole UFO picture, and that is secrecy.
Yes, that's the other thing.
People who keep trying to tell me that governments can't keep secrets.
Of course they can.
It would be out all over the place. There's a whole chapter in the book about that, because it's extremely important to recognize that secrets aren't just a matter of telling everybody and hoping nobody will talk. You have to have the appropriate clearance. You have to have a need to know. And it is pushed on you very hard that there are penalties should you break secrecy, and that they don't end when you quit your job or when the job is and program is canceled or anything like that. And the lack of imagination on the part of some of the nasty, noisy negativists is really impressive. And, you know, when I look at secret programs and tell people how big they are, I mentioned $100 million a year in 1958 on nuclear airplanes. But
which is incredible.
Well, the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, whose very existence was secret for 20 years, admitted last year that they were canceling a program of new satellite architecture that was being conducted by Boeing. And you know what? They'd already spent $18 billion, and they didn't get what they were looking for. $18 billion!
And how did they have that money? Because it certainly wasn't a
black budget. The budget that doesn't go.
It wasn't in the.
No, there wasn't a line item at Congress that said dumb program by NRO.
You know, I was going to say, what was it? Under non appropriated funds, miscellaneous, slush funds?
Well, wherever they find. That's those $160 toilet seats. You get enough of them, and you got a big research and development program.
Hey, you mean they charge $163 and part of that money actually goes into the other program? Is that what they're trying to do?
That's one of the things that happens. They grab money wherever they can. There are good people in the good, in quotes, good people in the government who are expert at pulling money from Project A to fund Project B, stuff like that. And like I say, many Americans just can't imagine. I get people telling me that, hey, Stan, all classified documents are declassified after 15, 20, 25 years.
And they're redacted.
Well, they're not declassified and automatically.
Right.
The Eisenhower Library still has 300,000 pages of classified material.
Wow.
He went out of office in 1961.
Yes.
You know, that's 47 years ago, for goodness sakes. And so I've been to 20 archives. I've had a, you know, that's one of my peculiar background attributes. I worked under security for 14 years, and I've been to 20 archives. Another one is, of course, that I worked on more canceled government-sponsored advanced research and development programs than anybody, I think. A third.
That's your good luck or what?
Well, yeah, you know, some people have talent. Another special attribute that I have is that I enjoy being on the stage, and at least until recently, I knew I could count on my memory because I've answered, I think, 50,000 questions over the years.
Right.
Same questions over and over again, of course, but
still.
I know very smart people who will give you a good answer tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
I was in high school debating.
Uh-huh.
And I learned a lesson from a fifth grade school teacher who told our class that the sun stood still and the planets moved around the sun, and that was it. And I said, no, Miss Kutkin, I had just read an encyclopedia the day before. You know, 29 cent a volume we paid for them.
I remember those.
The grocery store.
Yes,
and I said, no, the whole solar system is moving around the galaxy 12 miles a second, which seemed extraordinarily fast to me. Anyway, and she argued with me, and didn't argue, she just told me flat out, you know, that was wrong, that's not true, and blah, blah, blah. So I was an A student. When I came in the next day, I didn't sass the teacher, I brought the encyclopedia.
Well, that's what I would have
done. And she reluctantly agreed that, well, maybe that was so. And here's the kicker. I learned a big lesson. If you're going to take on authority, you better have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear, or you're going to get your head chopped off.
That's very true.
So I'm lucky that I have that skill built into me after all these years.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a fourth one, and again, this relates to the book. People they can accept the data, the large-scale scientific studies I present. I show a slide, I tell them what's in it, and I ask how many people here have read it, and if I'm lucky, it's 1 or 2%.
Mm-hmm.
But what they really want to know is the why questions. You know, why would aliens come here? Why doesn't the government tell us what it knows? Why don't they land on the White House lawn? You know, there are a lot of these sorts of questions.
Like Homeland Security?
But they, I have a whole article on my website, www.stantonfriedman, about the UFO why questions, and that's one of them. So people seem to think, the normal reaction when I give answers is, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. Well, of course they hadn't. I have to think about it because I'm going to get asked about it, you know.
Yes. Right, right.
And it, incidentally, when I talk about noisy negativists, in over 700 lectures, all 50 states, 9 Canadian provinces, and 16 other countries, mm-hmm. I've had 11 hecklers, and two of them were drunk. And the audience took care of the others, and you're going to get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics.
Or anything else.
Yeah, anything.
Basically.
You know, that's the way it is out there. So, what to get back to your original question, the idea yeah. behind the book was, you know, I only lecture for an hour, hour and a half, that sort of thing. I'll be speaking in West Virginia, St. Albans, West Virginia, on September 12th and 13th. That's the anniversary of the Flatwoods Monster case in 1952.
Oh, okay.
And I'll be with Frank Fascino, who wrote the wonderful new book, Shoot Them Down, which tells about the 52 wave and the fact that pilots were ordered by the military to shoot down UFOs if they don't land when instructed to do so. And you can make all the cartoons you want on that.
I'm sorry. Did they have a
system? And there was an Air Force general who said we scrambled them 300 times. And I've heard seven instances where apparently they shot back, which is a whole other story. And anybody listening, look at my website at www.stantonfriedman.com and let me know about what you know.
That's
right. I want to hear from people.
I guess, too, because my personal feeling is if I were to meet a larger, tougher person, it's like arguing with a truck with my small car. I'm not going to argue with it. And I'm
not a good idea.
Not going to try to get it forced off the road.
Well, not a good idea, and I'm sure the government wouldn't like to admit that, oh, by the way, if I've heard seven cases, there have been a lot more than that.
Of course.
That we've lost a lot of airplanes trying to shoot down these UFOs.
And yet they persist.
Well, I don't know when the order was taken back. I do know this. There's a wonderful book called By Any Means Necessary by William Burroughs, B-U-R-R-O-W-S, 2001. It's about a number of U.S. military reconnaissance planes that were tickling the radar systems in North Korea, Russia, and China. That's what they call it. They approach the coast, see how quickly the radar gets a lock on,
okay.
You know, all that sort of thing. Mostly back in the 40s and 50s.
A game of dare, double dare?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And the thing is that we lost 166 crew members, and there was radio communication. We knew that a lot of these people bailed out over enemy waters and all the rest of it. The families were told zero.
Oh,
unfortunate accident, lost at sea. Sorry about that.
Mm.
It wasn't until 2001 that a conference was called at which the families were given medals for their lost husbands, fathers, sons, whatever, and told what happened to them. So when anybody tells me, oh, they wouldn't they tell the families of the planes that got shot down? No,
probably
they wouldn't.
Not. Probably not.
And who wants to, you don't want the other pilots to think, you want me to go chase a saucer that's capable of blasting me out of the sky? No, thank you.
I don't understand what, my concept is, and it just be maybe my naivety. My concept is, what good does it do to lie? Because
well, it protects people in power.
So much. Well, to me, that's a false perception. It doesn't really protect them. What it does is create simply more ignorance and more havoc and more misfortune.
People
you know?
In power want to stay in power.
Well, that
if they
I
got a lie
with.
To do it, they'll do it.
Well, this I agree. I just don't understand why they think they can get away with it for so long. Because
the press has allowed them and the scientific community as well. I have a whole chapter in the book about press coverage, and it's been abysmal.
Yes.
Been a rotten failure. New York Times and Washington Post should be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah.
We're talking about the biggest story of the millennium.
Right.
And these guys treat it like Alice's Tea Party. And it's a new medical condition that I've described. the David Susskind syndrome. I was in New York to do his show, and between tapes, segments, he says, look, I read the New York Times. There's nothing there that says these things are real. So the syndrome is this. I'm a smart person who keeps track of all the important things that are happening in the world. If these things were real, alien spacecraft, any of them, and if the government was covering it up, that would be a big story. But if it were a big story, I would know about it, and I don't, so it must not be. And anybody who says it is must be some kind of a nut, and I'm not going to waste my time looking for information about something that isn't real, a self-fulfilling prophecy.
You know, that refers to me to a joke of mine. I don't know if you've ever heard it about the farmer and the giraffe.
No.
Oh, you could use it.
And you
feel free to. It's about this man and a farm, friend of his, a farmer. And the man's talking to him about these animals that he went and saw at the zoo and how exotic they were. And the farmer, who'd never been anywhere in his life, of course, no phone, no nothing, allowed us how they were all interesting. And until he got to the giraffe. And then the man described the giraffe. The farmer said, "Ain't no such animal." He said, "Yes, there is." And the guy said, "There ain't no such animal with a 6-foot-tall neck. Ain't no such animal." So they went along and frustrated. The friend one day took him to the zoo. And he saw all the animals and everything was fine. And they finally got him to the giraffe exhibit. And the man stood there for a while and stood there. And finally he turned around and walked away. And his friend, he didn't say a word, and his friend was dying to find out what he said. So finally he says, "Well, what did you think about the giraffe?" And the farmer turned and looked at him and said, "There ain't no such a thing as a giraffe. I told you that."
Don't bother me with the facts my mind's made up.
Yes, yes.
What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them.
And what it doesn't know can't hurt them, I guess, is another axiom, but that's not true either.
What was that one?
What they don't know won't hurt them.
Oh, yes. There's a third. If you can't attack the data, attack the people.
Yes.
And do your research by proclamation, because investigation is too much trouble, and nobody will know the difference anyway. You know?
Well, but it's also a form of ignorance is bliss.
Yes.
But
yes,
I'm afraid the Internet has pretty much squashed that, so any attempts to have that continue is not going to work. Do you know when they had that sighting over in, back in 92, was it? 94, maybe, over Phoenix?
They had 94. Phoenix Lights, March 13th.
Good for you. I was there in Phoenix at the time.
Oh, wait, 97. I'm sorry.
Okay, but I knew it was back then. I'm lousy with dates. I don't know why. Dates don't mean a lot to me. But I was there, and by golly, if somebody tried to tell me I didn't see what I saw and that it was balloons, I'm here to tell you they're lying in their teeth because I saw what I saw.
Well, the noisy negativists have come up with great responses. It was flares dropped by National Guard planes, except that happened at 10 o'clock, and your sighting occurred at 8:30.
Well, the thing is, there were no flares about it. There were lights. They were in formation. They moved. They rotated. They split off in different directions. They came back together. I mean, it was beautifully done. I admire the technique myself.
And it was quiet.
Yes, and there was no sound at all. And I got a crick in my neck from looking up. And there were other people there with me.
There were thousands of people who saw the Phoenix lights.
Yes.
And, you know, the governor didn't help any when he had a big press conference later in which he had one of his people wear an alien costume.
Oh, yes. Isn't that
and made fun of everything. It took him 10 years before he admitted publicly not only had he seen the lights, but he had been a pilot, a captain in the Air Force. And he knew darn well they weren't any conventional plane of any sort.
And yet he did it, and what was his reason for saying he did that?
To keep down panic, he said. He was afraid people were getting upset and disturbed and distressed, and he wanted to tamp down that, keep the public safe. What can I say? I mean,
people are not that dumb.
I don't think they are. I've given 700 lectures. I don't think they panic after my lecture.
No, and I don't think they panic. I mean, there's some. I mean, I wouldn't be too thrilled if an alien said, "Take me to your leader," and I said, "Which one do you want? Do you really want to talk to them?"
Well, that's one of my questions, of course.
Instead?
One of my questions is, is there a leader to be taken to? I don't know of anybody who speaks for planet Earth. That's one of the silly things about landing on the White House lawn.
Yes.
I mean, the president, I hate to smash people's concerns, but the president of the United States doesn't speak for 6.5 billion Earthlings.
No.
There are times when he doesn't speak for 300 million Americans.
Yes, that's true, too.
You know.
And what would they do if he showed up on the front lawn? Would they try to say that he never showed up at all?
Remember the day the Earth stood still?
Yeah. It's really kind of sad because, and I'm wondering if they all aren't shaking their head and saying, don't these people ever grow up and move beyond,
well,
certain...
I describe Earthlings from an alien viewpoint as a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare.
Right, exactly.
You realize the United States this year will spend well over half a trillion dollars on things military, the rest of the world another half trillion, and yet 30,000 children at least will die every single day of preventable disease and starvation. Now,
yes, I agree.
How do you reconcile those?
Well,
I have trouble.
Well, you don't, which is why we vote people in, you know.
I guess. Or vote people out, as the case may be.
Yeah. Well, in this case, we're taking care of that by getting a new set of people, we hope. But we'll do something, and I do not go into politics.
Well, yeah, I try to avoid that, too. I'm concerned about Earthlings and the future of our planet. And a recognition, tough as it may be, that we're not the big shots in the neighborhood. And, you know, people have had problems with that. But let's face it, the Pope within the last 3 months has said it was okay to
believe.
Think about aliens. You know, maybe he knows something we don't know about what's going to happen this year.
Well, you know, there's always the Lord's, prophetic opening from Lord's, the children of Lord's, that predicted things that were going to happen. And that has been a whole closely held secret and not opened up to the public. So, I mean, people seem to always want to protect people, and you would, which is, seems to me a very patronizing position to take, because if we weren't meant to know it, it wouldn't be brought to our consciousness, period.
We have learned to live with the notion of the atomic bomb, I think. And, you know, it's an illustration of our primitiveness that it wasn't until 1938 that we Earthlings, we smart Earthlings, another physicist, of course, found out or decided or determined would be a better word, I guess, that the sun produces its energy not by burning gas, by nuclear fusion. Now, that was 1938. We put that to use in our typical Earthling fashion. In 1952, we exploded our first H-bomb. The equivalent energy, this was in 1952, the end of October. It was had the power level of, a power equivalent of 10 million tons of TNT.
Wow.
Made a fireball 3 miles wide. Now, what do you suppose the aliens thought about that?
Well,
what does that tell you about these idiots on Earth?
They're playing with fire, and they don't know what they can bet how they could get burned. That's
one of the amazing things of the last 3 years is that an atomic bomb hasn't been exploded in anger.
That's a miracle. That part of it is a miracle, which I think we should all thank God for.
But I'm worried about, we've got some people now who don't seem to have qualms. As an example of that, I have great trouble wrapping my mind around the notion of parents being proud of a son who's a suicide bomber.
This is very true.
I just can't think in those terms, or a daughter, too, incidentally.
Yes.
And so that scares me, because somebody who has, bad guys who have atomic bombs may decide
that,
you know, it's a good thing to do.
A way to go out with a big bang, no pun intended.
Ooh, yes, indeed, indeed.
And I agree with you wholeheartedly. That's why there was that care. That's why the danger that exists. But, you know, I also trust in a higher power, and I also trust that we will not be blowing ourselves to king and come, because my feeling is there's a greater plan for us than being, you know, marshmallows at a feast. It's not one of them.
Marshmallows. Oh, what a gory
thing. I'm sorry. I
think it is useful to try to see ourselves as others see us.
Yes.
And it's scary, but it's useful. And I think, you know, the Olympics sort of symbolized the notion of being an Earthling. I was bowled over. I hadn't watched much of it, but saw much of the closing ceremonies today. And, you know, 204 countries, and apparently peaceably together. And, yeah, there were a few little incidents, but
nothing
you know,
really
worth talking about.
Yeah.
And what an incredible show, and how much effort was put on to make people feel good, and, you know, all the rest of that stuff.
Yes.
Earthlings, we should be thinking of ourselves as Earthlings. And to me, that's one of the fears of governments who don't want to tell us what's going on. I mean, there are the obvious things. You want to figure out how the darn things work so you can use them to deliver weapons and defend against other people.
Right.
That's the obvious reason number one. You got crash saucers from Roswell. See my book, Crash at Corona.
Right.
But so one of the things is you worry about the technology side. But another one is if you make an announcement, and I should have a competition, two people who are trusted all over the world to make the announcement. And, you know, at one time, Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America. Now, it's hard to find trusted people. But about the Queen and the Pope? There's an odd couple.
But
they're the same age, roughly, and, you know, saying that indeed some UFOs are alien spacecraft. What would happen? I mean, stock market would go down, mental hospital admissions would go up, church attendance would go up, I suppose. But to me, after 600 college lectures, no less the professional groups, I believe that there'd be a major push on the part of the younger generation, which, unlike me, was never alive when there wasn't a space program.
Exactly.
For a new view of ourselves, instead of as Americans, Canadians, Greeks, Peruvians, Chinese, as Earthlings.
Yeah,
and, you know, obviously from an alien viewpoint, we are all Earthlings.
Well,
we don't seem to like that very
like
much,
species.
You know.
Yeah.
And the big thing is, I don't know of any government on this planet that wants its citizens to owe their primary allegiance to the planet instead of that individual government.
Well, that's true. Again, we're going back to that concept that you said of individual power and the lust for power and really the understanding that power is an illusion.
Well, let's face it. Many Americans say, well, we'll hold an election to see who speaks for the planet. Hey, but wait a minute. The Chinese have 1.32 billion people. India's got a billion people. We only have 305 million people.
Right.
We're not going to hold an election.
No, it wouldn't.
You know, not an easy chore. How do you decide? Let's let the Olympic Committee. That would be the way to do it.
Well, they have their own issues.
Oh, boy, do they. But
the
point I'm getting at here is that we need to stand back and look at this from a larger viewpoint than, you know, just seeing a flying saucer. And when I say the press hasn't done its job, let me quote something from a memo put out by General Carol Bolander, and the quote's in the book. But he was asked in 1969 to decide what should the U.S. government, he was an Air Force general, what should we do about Project Blue Book? Because the University of Colorado study, the Condon report, had said, get rid of it, it's not doing anything. Well, his memo resulted in the closure of Project Blue Book. And what he said, he agreed with Condon's people, basically, was that buried in this memo, which had been classified and which a guy named Bob Todd, no longer with us, managed to get using Freedom of Information, he said, moreover, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with Joint Army-Navy Air Force Publication 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system.
Right.
But and two paragraphs later, he says, as if that wasn't enough, he said, look, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the procedures designed for that purpose. Now, when was the public ever told, hey, the good stuff didn't go to Project Blue Book?
No.
It went someplace else.
Yeah, everybody thought it went to Project Blue Book.
I found
remember the big hoo-ha about when it was closed because I didn't find any evidence.
Well, they were actually very careful in what they said, but the press was quick to give it far more meaning than they actually gave it. As a matter of fact, one of the things they said, no report collected, reviewed, evaluated by the United States Air Force gives any evidence of being a threat to the security of the United States. Now, you look at, well, wait a minute, what if one of those functions was done by the Navy, Office of Naval Intelligence, let's say, or the National Security Council, or the Majestic 12 group?
Right.
Would be a true statement, but it doesn't mean anything.
Doesn't cover everybody.
Well, that's right.
Limited. It's limited, yes.
Isn't it amazing how we always look toward the Air Force, but three-quarters of the planet is covered with water?
So it would be more the Navy, wouldn't it?
Well, they certainly have been involved, and you'd think the Air Force doesn't talk. The Navy didn't talk at all. I was in touch with their history office and stuff. I want your stuff on UFOs. We don't have anything. I sent him a report that was jointly made by Air Force Intelligence and Naval Intelligence, and had both their names on it. This is way back report. And the guy says, thank you very much for the interesting report, but as I've told you before, we don't have anything on UFOs. What are you going to do then? You know, I've talked to Navy people, you know, where a whole aircraft carrier, almost everybody saw the saucer flying by.
Yeah, and, yes. Did they wave?
Or, I don't know. They were seen by radar, and the logs were changed.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, again, the intimidation.
Yeah.
At the end of my lectures, all 700 of them just about, I ask, I get the first question. I say,
okay,
we didn't let the CIA in. I want to find out something. How many of you believe you've seen what I would consider to be a flying saucer, having defined my terms at the beginning of the talk?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just raise your hand, and I'll count. So I point and count. One, two, three, four. The initial hands go up very hesitantly, because
mm-hmm.
they know I'm not going to laugh. My lectures flying saucers
right.
aren't real, you know, but how
yeah.
about the rest of the crowd? And
yeah.
by the time I get to the other side of the hall, all the hands go up proudly and rapidly. Typically,
right.
it's 10%. Now, I mm-hmm. then ask, I mean, if I got 500 people, in other words, that's 50 sightings. That's a
right.
lot. I then ask, how many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down. If there's anybody left, I'll say, how many of you were in the military at the time? If there's still some hands left, I ask you, want to tell us about it. And now they have to make a choice. One guy in front of 1,350 people in Texas said, I can't. They told me not to say anything, which was a wonderful line.
Yeah.
And I had another guy say, they took my pictures. Everybody's waiting for the rest of the story. Nothing.
Uh-huh.
So I say, look, you don't need to stand up. I'm not asking your name, but
uh-huh.
I'm sure the audience would like to hear the rest. And everybody claps. And so he sat, told us he was piloting a four-engine airplane for the Air Force out over the Pacific,
right.
plane ahead of them 20 miles, daytime.
Right.
Says there's a saucer heading your way. They had gun cameras. They took pictures.
Right.
They radioed the base to which they were going.
Right.
Because the crew doesn't handle the film. That's an intelligence
right.
function. And some people seem to think that the crew would take the film to the local drugstore.
Yeah, right.
A chance to look
or your
at
Walmart
it.
And have it posted on your internet. Right, got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they get where they're going, the film gets taken, and they get debriefed and told never to say anything again. So I get a lot of stories like that. And anybody who thinks the CIA hired these people to tell me crazy stories, I think they're nuts.
Well, you know, I've talked to people as well in Virginia Beach at the ARE Association.
Oh, yeah.
For Research. Okay. I've talked to a dear friend of mine I've known 20 years, and I talked to him about this, and he said, yeah, he and his friends at home in Massachusetts, where he grew up, saw a UFO coming down a ditch. He said he was with some buddies. And it came straight down the ditch, and he looked at me and said, you know, I've never told that to anybody in my life. I said, well, what did you guys do about it? He said, nothing. And he
That's
said,
par for the course.
And they were kids. They were like, you know, 8 or 9 years old.
Sure, nobody would believe him.
Yeah, and he said, I said, well, didn't you even discuss it among yourselves?
No.
He said, no, we didn't do it because, and I said, what? And he said, well, I hadn't even remembered it until you started talking about it now. And he says, I don't even know why I'm talking to you about it. And I've had other people admit to me that they have seen UFOs, but if I tell anybody about it, they'll say I'm crazy or I'm a liar. And I looked at it and I said, and what is it do you think you're afraid of? I mean, if enough people see it, why would anybody think you were crazy? I mean,
because they bought into this crazy notion that most people don't believe in flying saucers, and the greater the education, the more likely not to believe. When in fact, and there's
wow.
a whole chapter in the book about polls, the greater the education, the more likely to believe
yes,
in flying
exactly,
saucers.
Yes, exactly, because, you know, well, I'm educated, and I damn well believe it. I'm not going to say I didn't see something when I did see it. What would be the percentage in lying to myself? None.
There isn't any, and people will talk to me because they know I'm
yeah.
not going to laugh. They you
yeah.
know, I sign a book,
yeah.
and they've got to tell me about their sighting, you know.
Yeah.
Did you report it? No. why not? They'd think I was some kind of a nut. I had an interesting experience with a class of about 100 students at a college, and I said, look, I want to know where you stand on some things, but I don't want you to be influenced by the other students in the class, so I'd like you to close your eyes
right. And
vote with your hands with your eyes closed. Your
mm-hmm.
instructor and I will count the votes.
Right.
About 100 students. 80% thought most people did not believe that any UFOs were alien spacecraft. But 80% of that group did.
Jeez.
That's a big dichotomy, you know?
Isn't it?
The reality is very different from the perception of the reality. But will you report a sighting? Will you sponsor a PhD thesis? Will you teach a course? Not if you think everybody else is going to say you're nuts. There have only been about 10 PhD theses. And there have been some courses, but not many.
Well, you know, it's sort of like the elephant in the room concept, isn't it? That you're not going to. There's an elephant that comes in the room,
yeah. But
nobody talks about it. It's very hard to ignore an elephant in the room, as far as I'm concerned. And why wouldn't you talk about it? That's what I don't understand.
Hey, I live in Canada, and our joke is when you're sleeping next to an elephant, you better be careful when he rolls over, and that's the United States he was talking about. Hey, Americans, I'm a dual citizen. I can complain about both governments.
I don't care if you criticize. I'm sure I can think of a few Canadian jokes if I really put my thought cap on.
Well, yeah, I care about both. But the kicker is many Americans don't even realize that Canada is physically larger than the United States.
Well, of course it is. All you have to do is look at a map.
Well, who looks at maps?
I do.
I do, too, because I think they're important.
Well, but, yeah, it helps, especially if you want to get from point A to point B. That's been my experience, however.
Well, that's
most
why...
Men, I do ask for directions.
that's why I talk in the book Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. I talk about the star map work that was seen by Betty.
Fascinating.
And it shocks people that... I get so sick of people talking about other galaxies. I don't care about other galaxies.
Oh, no.
Next big galaxy over Andromeda is 2 million light years away.
Uh-huh.
But our own galaxy, the Milky Way, is less than 100,000 light years across.
Right.
It's a big flattened spiral pancake, maybe 15,000 light years.
Right.
But within 55 light years, there's a couple of thousand stars, of which 46 or so are very similar to the sun and might be expected to have planets and life. So our local neighborhood, that's what I worry about. Now,
that's right.
In the Hill case, the map that Betty saw, and Dr. Simon asked her to draw later on if she could remember it accurately,
right.
And a brilliant woman named Marjorie Fish built 26 different three-dimensional models of our local neighborhood. Incredible amount of work.
Yes.
Was able to identify the base stars in this pattern that Betty saw. And it turns out they're quite remarkable. And it shocks people because here are two sun-like stars,
right.
Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, in the constellation of Reticulum. You can't see them from here. You've got to go below the equator to see them. They're only 39.3 light years away. That's just down the street compared to 2 million light years from the next galaxy.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking comparisons here.
Well, yeah, just down the street. Around the corner, okay. But the kicker here is that these two stars from each other are
mm-hmm.
only an eighth of a light year apart.
Mm-hmm.
That's 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. We're out in the boonies.
Yes, we are.
I don't mean Fredericton, New Brunswick, where I live, either.
No, I understand.
And the kicker here is another important point. Not only can you see the other star from a planet around the other one all day long because it's so close, but those two stars are a cool billion years older than the sun. Excuse me. A cool billion years older than the sun. Now, Friedman's Law, and I'm not one of the two Nobel Prize winners named Friedman.
I will grant you that.
But and they both had a connection with the University of Chicago, too.
Incidentally. Yeah.
Anyway, Friedman's Law is that technological progress comes from doing things differently.
Yes.
An unpredictable way.
Yes. That's
the future is not an extrapolation of the past.
Bless you. Well, to me, that's creativity.
Well, the kicker is then, in other words, a laser isn't a better light bulb, entirely different physics.
Mm-hmm.
So what if they're a little ahead of us, maybe only a million years? How about
mm-hmm.
1,000 years?
Mm-hmm.
How about 100 years? Look back 50 years and what do you see?
You just look back 100 years and we didn't have light bulbs.
Well, yeah, we didn't have many airplanes, or we had rockets. We didn't know about DNA and microwaves and the internet and all those great things we have. And I got a shock. I was talking to a class, two classes of students, actually, at University of Detroit a couple years back, and I mentioned that, gee, when I started working in industry, I was using a slide rule.
Right.
I looked around the class. Any of you know what a slide rule is? Not one student in the class.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No, I'm not. Made me feel old, because that was less than 50 years earlier at that time. But it illustrates the point. You know, the progress comes from doing things differently.
Well, that's why we build better mousetraps. That's why, supposedly, we're supposed to be technologically advanced, because we apply things in an innovative, outside-the-box thinking way. Except that if you get too far outside of the box, some people get too nervous about you not being able to control.
Well, you know, I'm just working on a book, probably another one with Kathleen Martin, called It's Impossible, Isn't It? And we're collecting all the stupid things that smart people have said about what was impossible.
Isn't that wonderful?
Boy, are there a lot of them.
Oh, God, yes. There incredible. So to me, innovation is when you do, as I say, think outside the box, but it's when you apply your creativity and your intuition. Because without that, there is no inventiveness. You have to put your left brain to sleep to let your right brain work.
Well, again, people in power want to stay in power. They don't want new ideas to come to the fore, because then
they'd
be left out.
Unless they can control it, right?
That's right. That's right.
That's that. And I don't believe in conspiracy theories either, by the way, because I think too many people go off on that, and then they become paranoid and cynical.
And, you know, when people talk about conspiracy theory, I say, look, I worked under security for 14 years. I don't think I was working. That's not a conspiracy theory. I knew what the rules were about secrecy.
Yeah.
I followed the rules. I did what I was supposed to do. I had signed papers saying I would do so.
Mm-hmm.
There's no conspiracy there. That's the way the game is played. That's the rules of the game.
That's right.
And, you know, don't tell me that, you're talking conspiracy about a cover-up. I said, look, not only has there been a cover-up, and I demonstrated in the book, and I don't know if you saw the Larry King show I was on July 18th with Bill Nye, the Deny guy.
Oh, yes, I saw part of that. Yes, sir.
He showed a document in which one line was redacted. You see, that's it's blacked out, in other words.
Yes.
That's the address of the guy, and of course that's taken out. There's no cover-up, so fortunately I had the book with me. And I could quickly get to the page, which shows one of the CIA documents that it took me 5 years to get, a CIA UFO document,
mm-hmm.
on which you can read 8 words. Everything else is blacked out.
Did you have that in your book? Because I remember something very, very similar. So, yes, okay.
Yeah,
boy,
it's in the book.
That, and I thought, wasn't that interesting? I wonder why they even bothered to send it to you.
Well, they fulfilled the rule. It only took them 5 years. They're supposed to respond within 10 working days.
Yes, I remember. I worked on the Hill when that was enacted, and had a chance that worked out real well. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, people say, aren't you frustrated by getting all those blacked out? And the new thing with the NSA is whited out documents. I got 160 pages of UFO material, and you could read one line per page. Everything else is whited out. And when I called them to get a new set of these released, in quotes, documents, the gal was reading an article that somebody had written saying, Friedman shows us blacked out documents on television. He doesn't tell people it's sources and methods information, which of course I do.
Yeah.
So that was one of the reasons they put out these whited out documents. They're not as powerful on television.
It's all in the look, darling. It's all how you dress.
Yeah, I'll tell you. And so you get the response from people, whited out or blacked out, people who didn't realize. I've had people ask me, is that legal? I say, sure it's legal. And aren't you frustrated by not getting more? Well, I'd like to get more, but at least it proves they're covering something up.
Because
and
it's not,
that's an important point.
Yeah. Well, as I said, it makes no sense to me, because if something is going to come out, quite frankly, it's going to come out, and you can sit there and suck your thumb, or you can sit there and, you know, draw pictures and deny all you want, but it's going to happen. I think I heard a beep, which means we may be coming down to the wire.
Okay.
So do please give your information out.
Okay.
Your book was marvelous. I'm not a scientist, but I loved it, and I enjoyed reading it, and I'm looking forward to your next book.
Okay.
You've been a darling.
My website is www.stantonfriedman.com. That's F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
The book is Flying Saucers and Science. The address is Post Office Box 958,
mm-hmm.
Houlton, H-O-U-L-T-O-N, Maine, which is M-E, 04730-0958. And the advantage of buying your books from me is you get an autograph with all books I send out. I personally autograph them. So I don't mind if they buy them from Amazon or any place else. Barnes & Noble has the books. But the important thing is to get people to recognize there's an overwhelming amount of evidence out there. We are being visited. There is a cosmic Watergate. And we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium, visits to planet Earth.
Do you feel that there is going to be more obvious contact in the not-so-distant future, in the next few years, say?
I'm an optimist. I'm getting old there, and I want it to happen before I pass from this mortal coil. So I hear things that suggest that may be the case.
Okay. Well, maybe another time we could talk about that,
because
I'd love to be able to be in on that. I would have so much fun talking to those people.
Yeah, I'll bet. Me too.
Well, blessings, and thank you again. You've been delightful.
My pleasure.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed today's talk. We had so much fun and so interesting, and I learned a great deal.
Good.
I'm Phyllis Pricer, your hostess with Higher Dimension. Thank you so much for listening to BBS Radio. I'm sorry, I can't even think of it. My tongue and teeth are tied in knots. But at any rate, you all know what I mean, and God bless you all. We'll see you next week with a new show. Again, you have a wonderful weekend, and thank you so much for your time. Goodbye.